concept of the sophomore slump. It's when someone's second effort fails to live up to the standards set by their first effort. Most of the time, it's used to describe when musicians or bands have a hit debut record, but their second record bombs. It's not a hard and fast rule, but it happens enough that it's a thing. And obviously, there are tons of second records that are amazing, but that's not the point. I was thinking about the concept of the sophomore slump the other day. If you make something that everybody loves, and then you make the record that you really, really, really want to make and nobody likes it except for you, is it a success? A while back, I listened to an episode of a fantastic podcast called Cocaine and Rhinestones about Bobby Gentry. I'm not a country guy, so I didn't know who Bobby Gentry was. Her first record sold a bazillion copies because of a single called Ode to Billy Joe. Of course, the thirsty record companies wanted more of that. They gave her carte blanche on her follow-up record, and she made an epic, sprawling, textured, thoroughly modern record that cost tons of money for personnel and studio time. And despite favorable reviews, nobody bought it. All right, some people bought it, but the record company was not happy. According to Wikipedia, Bobby said, "I didn't lose any sleep over it. I've never tried to second-guess public taste. If I were just a performer and not a writer, I might have felt more insecure about the whole thing." According to a quote on the Cocaine and Rhinestones website, she also said, "Success is recognition and an open channel for creative energies, but I'm tired of hearing artists say they don't perform for money." She was under contract, so I assume she got paid. So maybe she really didn't care. But I can't help but wonder how she felt about it at the time. Finishing the record must have been so satisfying. She had creative control and she made the record that she wanted to make. And good reviews are fantastic. But then what? Was she confused, disappointed, or just happy to be making art? I'm guessing that it's more complicated than any of the quotes I've read. I'm pretty sure I would have been okay with it, especially considering the record company paid for it. But I think that I would have also been a little bit confused and disappointed if nobody liked it. You put yourself out there for a reason. It's not just because you want to get paid. You want to be accepted by your peers, and you're making this thing for a conceivably huge audience, and you assume that they're going to be into it. And then it turns out that you just don't understand what everybody wants. It's great that the record company paid for it, and I guess they ate the loss. But I also wonder how she would feel, or how I would feel, if making that record also bankrupted her. It didn't bankrupt her, so we'll never know. Her career was relatively long and lucrative, and now that record, the Delta Suite, is considered an ahead-of-its-time masterpiece. I had never heard of it before listening to the podcast, but I totally dig it. It's really good. But that has almost nothing to do with today's episode. It's music-related, but it's sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum of country music. This is a good time to let you know that you are listening to episode 19 of Feel Free to Deviate, the podcast about people, their careers, and their relationships with success. My name is Jim Turbert, and I'm the host. This episode features Thomas Margolf. Some people know him as Firestarter. Some people know him as Frau Holla. I just call him Thomas. To my knowledge, he's never experienced the sophomore slump. I met him many years ago at a chip music event in New York City. If you don't know what chip music is, hang in there. We're going to talk about it, or you can Google it. Chip music is not really my thing, but I have friends, and some of them are interested in chip music, and they perform at chip music events. I go to support them because I am a great friend. I met Thomas through my chip music VJ friends, and then he married another friend, and now we hang out sometimes. He's a hardworking man, and he's in demand, but he gave up his job to start a company called XOR Electronics. And he designed and manufactured something called the NerdSec. Now he works extra hard, but it's all for him, and that is awesome. I'm not going to tell you any more about what he does in the intro. You'll have to listen for that. Please, settle into whatever you're doing and enjoy my conversation with Thomas Margolf. Hi, Thomas. Thanks for being on the show. Could you please introduce yourself and tell me what you do?
Yeah, I'm Thomas. I'm in my 40s, father of two girls. I'm a kind of an artist in a way, but I'm also developing synthesizers and making electronic music instruments at the moment.
At the moment, yeah.
It's something I want to keep for the future, of course, but you never know what's going on. And sometimes I'm more I'm making music as well, but that is a bit like I don't really have time to make music at the moment. I keep developing my my products, my synthesizers or sequencers in. That with the hope that I would have some time to make music again at some point, but that will happen also. Basically, my main thing, what I do, I made my hobby as my company, I would say.
And that's why I asked you to come in.
Yeah.
Because that's freaking awesome. That's like the coolest thing that anyone can do, right?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
I don't know if it's the coolest, but it's really cool.
It is. It is. The crazy thing is that it also loses its... what you think about what it could be like, oh yeah, I could do this all day, It loses its
appeal.
Yeah, it's a bit. It's not like that I totally like what I do, but at the moment it gets a job, it's different. It's going to be a different
thing. It
really
feels like a job.
Yeah, it feels like a job. And right. and you feel the pressure that you have to deliver something. And of course, it's always with things, you know, if you make music and people know you, You have to keep on to deliver
producing
stuff.
Things, of course.
If you make art, you made something and you got to deliver stuff.
You're only as good as your last hit.
Yeah, exactly. And also for yourself, feel like the thing, like you have to go on. You have to do something. You always jump also to the next thing. What you're going to do. And with this here, it's like with a job, it's like also pressure because it has to pay your also your money, your income, and yeah,
a lot of responsibilities.
Responsibilities, exactly. And then it's different than the hobby part, because with the hobby part, it's like, oh, you do something, oh, it works for me, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation, it's not enough anymore if it works only for me.
And now it needs to work for everybody else.
Yeah, well, of course. You know, if you make something yourself, you know the quirks of your stuff. You know the issues. Maybe.
Yeah, it becomes part of your workflow or whatever.
Yeah, and then it's fine. You know, then it's fine because you can work with it and it's not a problem for you because you know what you don't have to do. For example, to let it crash.
Don't touch that button.
Yeah, for example, yeah. And the moment other people are using your things... It's totally different. And of course, you find out that you forgot about this part and about this part. And then you see your own thing from a lot of different views that you didn't see yourself, which is also, of course, typical thing about developers and programmers and thing, because it's like starting like how you want it. And not everyone sees it like this. That's part of the thing as well. And it's still glorious. It's still nice.
It is glorious.
Yeah.
The whole theme is of the podcast. It's about people talking about their relationships with success. And there are different ways to measure success over time. After this is what, the 19th episode. I think most people sort of agree that it's finding some sort of self-satisfaction. It's not necessarily about money. To me, it seems like you've reached a level of success that most people maybe never do. You've had this hobby of making electronic music for however long you've been doing that. We can get into that later. And you always had pretty good programming jobs because you have programming skills. But the fact that you were able to give up actual jobby jobs that gave you money, that's incredibly brave. First of all, it's hardware, and making hardware is hard. They should call it difficult-ware.
Yeah. It's hard, yeah.
Because they're giant competitors with huge amounts of money, and some of your competitors could make a product that completely fails and it won't matter to them because they'll just make another one.
Yeah.
And you are a guy renting a space with a small team. If your product fails, then you're kind of screwed.
Yeah, true. But that is the thing is, if I compare it with the big companies, is that I have the flexibility to do this kind of stuff, to move somewhere that I think like, oh, okay, this is a good way to move. And with big companies, it's more like they have a line and they keep a line, and they can't really do the quirky moves to do something that is not like, let's say, mainstream. And it's not like, you know, they're totally fine mainstream instruments.
Of course, there are
perfect. You know, it's like which
they're
I love.
Amazing.
But that's a nice thing of being small, and it's not really a team. So I'm alone actually doing this, and I get some help for production, but I do all the development and things. That's the good part of just being me, because I can go all directions at any point.
Yeah.
If it makes sense or not, that's another thing. And then you can like do stuff that you didn't plan in the first place.
Sure.
And it fits in your thing. And I think that's with big companies not possible. You know, they have plans, and they have shareholders and they have decided, don't do the risks. And that's a bit a different thing.
Yeah. If you're the only shareholder, I guess you're the only one that you're going to let down.
Yes. and
your children.
And my family. Yeah, exactly. That's a part. And what you said, I always had a full-time job to work. And evenings I made my hobby projects, or when I had time to do the stuff. And I had already a product ready, and I started already to sell it. But I never had the idea to quit my day job because it was too risky for me.
It just didn't make sense.
Yeah, it was too risky for me, and because I have like the family, and we have to pay the rent, and so it never came in my mind. And we've been at friends, and I had a chat about it and thing, and they're totally not into this thing. But he said like, but why don't you just try it? You know, why don't you just try it? And, you know, if it fails, then you can get another job and things. And I have to say, in the Netherlands, as an embedded engineer, what I am, or a developer, it's not a problem to get a job.
No, I suppose not.
And so 2 weeks later, I quit my job. After that, and before, I didn't think about it 1 minute, but I always had plan B and plan C.
What sort of programming do you do? Because I actually have no idea.
I'm embedded developer, and I'm doing programming for microcontrollers in different languages.
Like, for industrial purposes, or?
Yeah, like this. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. There's a lot of demand
embedded
for that.
Development, and there's demand for that, especially here in this area. You get job offers even if you don't look for a job. So, so that's a bit the situation. And that was like never the idea to do this. And then it was like, boom, okay, I do this.
All right, why not?
And
But it's going well.
It's going well, yes.
I mean,
it was building it up.
Yeah.
And that's also the strength of what I think what I do, because I put all my energy in it. As well, it's not like that I get up at 12 because I can.
Right.
And let's do like two hours. And then
I'll do it tomorrow. It's fine.
It's actually, and I thought like, okay, it would be fine, because if you're not motivated this day, you just stay home and just hang around and do the thing.
No, for real.
Because you could do that.
It's key.
I think I did it one or two times.
Yeah.
In, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now.
It's okay to do it one or two times.
Of course. Now it's a bit like before you think, you could do it. And then when you're on it.
Right.
And probably also because it's working well, then you keep on. You know, you don't lose the motivation.
Okay.
If it wouldn't have worked out, then it would probably also different thing.
So the secret is actually thinking of it as a job. Make sure that it's your job instead of just continuing it in the hobby realm. It has to get out of hobby space and really, really. That reminds me, when I first got here, I did all kinds of weird little jobs, and I was supposed to like a gallery watcher at this installation that Eric van Lieshout did in the south, in the Zuidplein mall. You know who he is, but I'm gonna tell other people. Eric van Lieshout is a very famous Dutch artist. Dutch people can get artist subsidies. This might sound crazy to an American audience that the government gives artist subsidies. A lot of criticism from the people says that art is just a hobby for some people. And I mean, in a way, they're right. Some people get these artist subsidies and they just wake up at 12 and they buy sneakers and then they get the next subsidy if they can. But I can tell you that this guy, this famous guy, he's not getting any subsidy. He probably got some kind of a subsidy. But this guy, every time I talked to him, he was like on fire to get back to the studio. Have to go to the studio I really need to get to the studio. And like constantly working. And that's kind of the thing. Like, you can't just start one of these things if you're just going to loaf around.
Yeah, exactly. I think except for if you have the golden shot, and then it's like, then it's, if it goes easy for you.
Right.
You know, if you're that popular that it doesn't really matter what you do, it's special.
Right.
In a way.
I mean, but how do you get to that point? You gotta do something to get to that point,
of
right?
Of course. Yeah, that's of course. It's not definitely not easy for people or for artists to get the next funding or anything. It's
very competitive. It's very competitive.
Yeah.
It's less competitive than it is in America, but it is still competitive here, at least to get the real money.
Yeah, and then you have to put the money in your work as well.
You have to learn how to budget and do
exactly,
do all the stuff, because you can't just live like high on the hog. You have to actually make something, and things cost money. Anyway, I think that the fact that you were able to quit your job means, you know, that's a pretty significant level of success. How do you feel about success? Do you think of yourself as successful, or is that like just ongoing, or how do you look at it?
I don't know. I don't think about this normally.
Yeah.
When I did this, then I, when I started this, I made a first small batch of this thing I made,
mm-hmm.
The sequencer in that case. Then I thought, oh, I make 50 pieces of it.
Yeah.
Then we'll see. And that's different numbers now. It's a success because I thought already 50 pieces would be a success. Where does the success go? I think the success is the whole thing. I don't know what you build up, mm-hmm. and what to be around,
yeah.
is already a success.
Yeah,
I think,
mm-hmm.
and it can be much smaller than it is now.
Yes,
it could be a success already.
Of course,
that's how we see it in a way. And what is more than success? More success? I don't know.
I'm just wondering if you thought about it, or if it's just something that the reason I think about it and the reason I started is just because, you know, I'm unemployed and it's a strange realization and it's hard to find a job and I just feel like basically like a failure. And so I want to talk to people that seem to be doing things that are cool, or it's not just people who do cool things. Like, obviously everyone's not building synthesizers, but like I'm going to talk to a high school teacher in a little while. I'm going to talk tonight. I'm going to talk to someone else. It's just like people who got to where they are. Maybe they had some ideas about what they wanted to do, and maybe they reached those goals and maybe they didn't reach those goals. Yeah. And I want to talk to all of those people. I want to talk to the people who fell on their face, too. When I first met you, I think the first time I met you was in New York for a chip music thing. Marlene and I drove down from Boston to visit Julian. And that was the first time I met you. And it was before that you were with Luce. And it was before any of that.
Yeah.
It was like eons ago. You were a baby. And we were babies. Everyone was babies.
That's also like the thing, you know. I was making a bit chip music, which is like a bit on the internet. And not popular anything, but I could make
a community.
It's a community. I could make a tour in the States. You know, that's like
how cool is that? So you find this thing that you're really super into,
and then
you're able to turn it into something else. So I mean, I don't know when you started that, but that must have been, I don't know, 2005, 2004.
Yes,
so like it was a long time ago. Yeah. And now you're actually making your living doing that. It's like a kid who gets into skateboarding and becomes a pro skateboarder, my friend's brother-in-law makes snowboarding videos. It's kind of like that.
Yeah,
you're turning your passions into a job.
Of course, yeah. And I see you with a big smile on your face now. And I am also smiling. But the thing is, like, it's, you know, when you have a day job, then you work from 9 to 5, then you go home.
Yeah.
And it's done.
Oh, yeah.
And if you do this,
right,
then you work 24/7, and then it's not done either.
It's never,
That's the thing. Of course, I don't work 24/7.
No, of course not.
But I make normal hours still, but I feel like responsible for my product.
Yeah, of course.
For example, I have my idea is just like, because I'm selling around the world, my idea is at this point, someone is, let's say in the States, mm-hmm. is trying to make music, but this and this function doesn't work as he expected.
Right.
And I want to help him
at
this point, because what is worse than being in flow and then something doesn't work as you want it? I feel responsibility for that. But then again, this is also again the strength of that I can do what I want to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I want to help him or her. And I want to be there. And I can be there. And big companies, they have like a support line. And they don't help you. Or you get 3 days later, you get an answer of the email. We will look into it and get back to you. And I have the direct line. And if I feel it's a problem, then I make a direct line to be there, to help, or to say like, okay, hey, you can do it like this and this. And I see the issue and I will take care
of it. Next revision. I'll deal with it in the next revision.
Yeah, but I often, 1 hour later, I send a new firmware
that
he can do what he wants to do. And then it will, of course, later go to the main revision something. And that's also like a thing, because like a lot of people use things totally different than I ever expected. And then this can happen, of course.
Of course.
And I have to say, it's nice. I don't have a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice thing. But that's also like working to it, because every time when there was an issue, it was solved within no time. When you have a problem with your, I want to say DVD player, but that's so 90s.
What's that?
I don't know with what. If you have an issue and then, no, it's not getting solved. Mm-hmm. Maybe half year later, most probably not, because you got to buy a new one.
That's generally how it goes.
And my strength here, and that's why I still sell this first product, is that I keep improving it.
Right.
And not, of course, I fix the issues, and they're rarely issues. I keep adding functions to it. And that's what people really like. And that's why it's
successful, if you will.
Yeah.
We said, when we were talking about the chip music thing, it's like a community. Like, there's a community
of course,
people.
Yeah.
And that's why you were able to go on a tour in America.
Which I paid myself completely. But still, you could go out and play next to
CBGBs.
Yeah,
exactly. Not anymore, you can't, but it's...
yeah, but that was cool, you know?
Yeah, it's totally cool. And just poking around online, you see that there's a community around the NerdSec as well. Maybe it's a subsection of a larger community, but there are lots of firmware updates. It's not one of those things where you buy some kind of a niche product and they say, it's totally expandable, and then the company just kind of disappears, and there's never any firmware updates.
You know, it's a bit a thing. I can understand when and why this happened. Let's say this fancy Kickstarter project comes there. It looks totally cool. They have a lot of backers. They made, whatever, 500,000 euros of it, and they can't deliver.
Right.
Because
hardware is hard.
Because hardware is hard, because something in the production line went wrong, because they got a burnout, they were not able to finish it, because also with the product, it's always the hardest part is the last, let's say, the last 10 meters. The hardest part, you know, and the last 10 meters sometimes take as much time as the kilometer before it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the mile before it.
No, thank you. people are listening. I'm so confused. What's he talking about?
Yeah. No, but it's like the last finishing touch is the most time consuming thing. You know, I'm someone, I have 20 projects running normally.
Yeah.
I'm that kind of guy. I don't finish one of these. I have them all kind of running, but I don't finish them.
Yeah.
Before I started the company, before I started to develop this product, what I have now, before I made the company, I wanted to focus only on this. And I had all the projects, I looked to them, and I put them in front of me. And I said, okay, I pick five of these projects that I will finish. And the rest, I don't...
Just throw it away.
I leave it, yeah. And that's what I did. And I finished these five projects. I think it was three projects or something. And then they were gone. Then I focused only on this one thing.
Right.
Yeah, I can imagine that, because this project I finished, it was also always the last part that I had to finish. Mm-hmm. Because I had a running thing, like a kind of proof of concept thing. That was also like, I'm not motivated to finish it because, it's running kind of and it's working for me. That's the part, it's working for me.
Right.
And then you don't finish it. I did that and focus now on one thing. Yeah, I don't have this anymore, that I have like a lot of projects floating. And that's like a good part, to concentrate on things. And I can imagine going back to the Kickstarter thing, to get to the last mile. Or maybe to find people to help you with last mile, because it's like
to make
a product is difficult in one person, because you're not only hacking in the computer. You have to make the video for it. You have to do the socials for it. You have to order the parts at this company. You have to do the bookkeeping and all the stuff
you don't
normally do.
Yeah, the boring stuff is the worst.
Yeah, and you have to time schedule that you maybe have to, you know, I will release in 1 month. And then you have to be finished in 1 month. Or you have to be honest, because I also delayed sometimes things, but I was always open. Everything I do is quite open. So if I can do stuff, then I... say, I can do it. And if I know it's maybe can't do it, and I also say, like, it's maybe not possible, I will try, but it's
sure.
You know, I'm very open.
Make promises.
Exactly. And I'm very open with stuff. Yeah, that's the positive part of it. And doing the last mile is probably also something I can do, and probably something why I have something that is working. That is on there. And that's,
focus is key sometimes.
But it's not always easy, because also with every firmware, it's also a lot of the last mile parts that I have to do, because I have to function running and it works well. But then I have to do how you can edit it, and the workflow part, which is the most difficult thing for me to think about, not to implement, but to think about it.
Yeah, you don't know what other people's weird workflows are either. I know whenever I figure out some new software or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I watch a YouTube video, I'm kind of surprised how other people do the same thing that I was doing.
Of course, yeah. and if you don't have a team, you can't always think about how people would use it. Sometimes you think, oh yeah, that's good, and you hear from someone, oh yeah, but that would be much easier. Look, use this button or something, and then I didn't think about
that. No-brainer.
That's a bit the difficult part of that, to get the last mile done and to be ready for the release. So I'm very sorry for all this Kickstarter project who didn't make it in the end, and for all the backers for it. But I can understand some part of it. But of course, not the people who earn some millions and disappear somewhere or something.
That's terrible.
I think the most are really intent to do something, and then maybe it turns out that
they just don't understand that hardware is hard.
Yeah, probably there are a lot of problems on the way to get there. I think, and so it's I had also problems on the way, but I couldn't manage them always so far.
Well, I mean, the thing is actually built now, so unless you're working on revision 2, I suppose that it's all typing firmware, right?
Oh no, it's like arranging the production, and that's a big problem days because
supply chain.
Supply chain, exactly. That's a big problem. So like when you find out, okay, I'm running out of this and this component,
mm-hmm.
and then you look it up and you get like, okay, March 2023
Ooh,
as
that's
a
tough.
Delivery date, and you need it next week, something like this.
That's hard.
Yeah, if you're in the business, let's say it like this, in the electronics, then you know already quite some time that this is going to happen.
Yeah.
Or you are warned. People heard it in the news. Before it started to happen, we knew it before that point already, that it's going to happen. I bought a lot to survive for a year, to be able to produce for a year.
Was that enough?
So, no. And then it started for me as well, but I could manage that as well. You do some risks. Of course, like if you need a microcontroller or this kind of thing, you can go to brokers and they make a horrible price for you for the same thing.
But at least you get it.
And you hope you get a good thing, because that can happen. That
you get subpar you get subpar components.
Yeah, or like fraud.
Not like they don't even work.
Could be. But I made always like good thing, like getting the examples and get it assembled and check if it's the real thing. And I could manage it so far. And yeah, we are not over this now. But
nope.
Probably still takes one more year or something until it's settling again. That's a bit the difficult part, because I have to take care for the production. And I'm also doing products which belong to the ecosystem that I'm doing, like the NerdSec, that's the sequencer.
Mm-hmm.
And you have expansion modules for it. And they are also own products in a way. So I still have to develop them. I still have to produce them.
It just occurred to me that it could be that some people listening to this don't know what that stuff is. The main product is called NerdSec.
Yeah, Nerd and Sec for sequencer.
There you go. What's a sequencer?
Synthesizers are music generators. You can see it as like your keyboard.
Most
could
people
be,
probably picture a keyboard.
Yeah, a keyboard, exactly. Well, the keyboard has presets, like a piano sound or like...
Vibes.
And with the sequencer, you can control this keyboard, so you could record things into it and then you can replay it on the keyboard. But it's more like that you really compose on my sequencer.
Mm-hmm.
Compose the music, and you have the multi-tracks, so you can compose on different layers. And then in detail, this is a Eurorack sequencer. And Eurorack is a kind of a system which goes back to the 70s or even earlier, when there haven't been these keyboards to make your music. It hasn't been there. So and there are different kind of modules, which are like parts that are built in the keyboard as a module. Like you put it in a rack, put your screws in there, and then you connect cables in front of it,
mm-hmm.
to another module.
So good.
And so you build up your own kind of sounds. And then there are oscillators, which are like tone generators. And then there are filters, which make the sound of the tone more interesting.
Yeah.
end and the envelopes which control the volume. We get, for example, like this sound of a bell. It's like, bang, and then it fades out. That's an envelope that's generating it. And to recreate natural sounds, that's what it's done for. Of course, it sounds synthetic, and that's the goal also of it. You know,
if you want a bell exactly sound, like a bell.
No. But it's that's the interesting part, of course, of it. But with this Eurorack system or modular system, Eurorack is just one part of it. There are different modular systems. With this, you generate your own sounds, and there are also sequencers for this to generate your music. But most of them have been very simple. Like that they do 8 steps, that means 8 steps like dun, 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 dun,
okay.
Dun, 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 dun. Then you begin with the first step again. So very simple thing. Can be really nice. It's repetitive and you create loops. And of course, it can be more interesting. You make short melodies. And that's a bit also a typical thing for Eurorack or modular music. That's like repetitive music drones and things. I've decided to put this into Eurorack because it's more than just like this loops. You can create whole songs with it and things. And that's like one part. It's not one part that was missing because there are other sequencers which are also complex or more powerful. Mm-hmm. But it's one of them. It's one of the powerful sequencers there. That's one creation tool that you can use to make your music with a Eurorack system. You can compare it with like a DAW in your computer.
Yeah. Digital audio workstation.
Exactly. But then a bit more limited because it's an embedded system. Of course, your computer runs on gigahertz with gigabyte of memory and with a widescreen and everything and or 2 screens or even more.
But I'm not going to bring the iMac up on stage.
No.
I guess you could, but...
Yeah. And this one is, of course, an embedded system.
But right.
Then it's dedicated for it, so it doesn't run an operating system, I think. So that's a bit a different part. And the whole Eurorack scene is like a constantly growing... So it's like, I think, I don't know the numbers now, but at some point it was like some years ago, it was like 40% growing a year.
Oh, wow.
So
there's
it's also kind of also getting hip to be there. And it's for a lot of musicians, which made music with computers, the next step to like, oh yeah, I want to make my own sounds and don't want to use the sounds that are available. No, I want to create my own things and I want to research music. I want to research sounds.
Yeah.
And that's also why it's interesting, you know, it's like when you're into something, you want to, at some point you want to know how it's done, how you make it. And that's like what a lot of people feel. And of course, it's trendy also to have like this big module in front of you with
weird looking
thousands
stuff.
Cables. And
it does look cool.
And every time when you're at the airport, they ask if it's a bomb or not. And this kind of stuff. There are a lot of video photos of that when someone was standing there again with the security guy and explaining. I never been stopped, but if I get stopped, then I'll say like, hey, I'm a DJ.
Yeah.
That's it. That it works because they don't know anyway. So, and I'm not a DJ.
Eurorack, nerd sec, blam, blam.
Yeah, exactly. Can you turn it on?
Well, yeah. Well, what's the genesis of your interest in this stuff? When did you start? Well, I don't even know what's better to approach. When did you start with electronic music? Did you do other types of music before you started getting into electronic music?
Let's say when I started with electronics.
Okay. That was my next question.
Okay.
But no, do what
I
you
think
go
that's,
for.
That's the timeline. That's
okay.
The timeline.
Electronics first.
Electronics first, because I was in the, what's the name, like in the box as a small kid, and my mother gave me a radio and screwdriver and turned it on.
No. And, for real?
Yes. Because I always did that.
Yeah.
Doing opening stuff. So that was fun. And maybe I have in my head, and maybe it's not like this. You know, in the 80s, 70s electronics, the capacitors had like, they were fancy, like looked like big, like chewing gums with different colors and things. And maybe this was like what I really liked.
Does look cool.
I don't know. And then I was always busy with that, doing like electronic stuff from early age.
Okay.
And I always made music or we played in a band. And
what do you play?
I was a bass player.
Okay.
Bass and keyboards, mostly. Yeah. But, you know, I never really learned making music.
Take lessons or just
no.
Just messing around with your friends?
Yeah, and in school band, and of course I learned a bit there, but I didn't really learn an instrument. I could play the guitar, but I could do all the chords, but that's it, not really deeper than that.
I understand.
And I know where the keys on the keyboards have been, but that's all, you know, it's like, not like, but I was always busy with that, and I was always going on with that. And I liked home computers, which brings us to the chip music part, so I was always also into computers, and then I started making music with the computers, which was a special thing, of course.
Yeah.
Back in the, I would say early 90s, maybe, or end of the 80s, I made music playing on the computer keyboard, playing the notes there and doing something. And then later, like also using sequencer programs on these home computers to create songs.
Now, is this an Amiga or is this, I know.
I have to say this was already PC times.
Okay.
Early PC times.
I just asked if it was an Amiga because
Before it was Commodore 64, I never had an Amiga back in the day.
Don't worry about it. It's not necessary.
I have a big home computer collection now and have all the computers, but back then I didn't have.
Right.
So I only had the cheap one. But it was still, that's also like makes you creative if you have the limitations.
Sure.
That's right.
Of course.
And then what I always liked with chip music, like to create with the limitations, to create something still nice. So yeah, I made always this music for me and listening to friends, and they're like, oh yeah, it's nice. It sounds a bit like a computer game.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. It was yep. And then it was like, I think in 1998. I was going to demo parties also, and demo parties is like where like computer programmers and hackers and stuff meet up in a big sports room with 500 computers, and everyone brings his gear.
Yeah.
And they're making competitions, who's coding the best demo, who's doing the best music on the thing. And I went there and I joined it. I joined also music competition. I failed totally.
Awesome.
Somehow my songs came through the internet to some other portal, and that was like a community called Micro Music. That's where I also met Julian and a lot more people.
That little American guy in the jumpsuit.
Exactly.
I don't remember his name.
I
think he was from California.
Exactly. That's like, and it was like a kind of community that was before Facebook and before all this social stuff going on. This was like they also called it a community more than like a platform where you can download music or upload music. And and then when they started, they asked, they sent me mail, hey, I found your songs, could we use it? We are busy with this platform and for the music, and and if they could use it. And so I was there from the beginning in this community, and it was growing really fast.
It's exciting, though. It must have been super exciting.
Yeah, because at this point, it was like directly, there are more people than me interested in this thing.
This is a good thing about the internet.
Yeah. And then that was like this motivation part again, like, oh yeah, cool. And then you produce more or you make more than you did before.
Yeah.
And like, oh yeah, motivation. And then it started also to play live at some point. That was like 2000, 2001, going on stage with that. And then we're going with the home computers or with the Game Boy and with this kind of limited instruments on stage and played. And it worked. It didn't work always, but it worked most of the time. So that's, but I think that's always the thing with non-mainstream music, or when you're like a small musician and
the stakes are low.
Yeah, exactly. But it's that's the thing, and I'm totally realistic about that. Or now I am. Then back then I thought like, oh cool, I can do it. And if an evening went well and we had a cool party, and then I was like, yeah, I can make it, can go big and can live from music. Of course, it never happened. And there's also a reason for it, because it's too niche. But then
there was a moment though.
No, there is a moment where this is big. This happened some years ago, where it really was increasing, and now there's a big, big scene. Not only chip music anymore, but the whole culture is big. My daughter, and she's not she's listening to chip music songs.
Not because of
I
you.
Don't even know about, and
oh, for
she's
real?
Not not because of me, because she didn't. She's too small, and when I was still active in chip music, that she was not born yet. And right after that, I at some point I stopped a bit with chip music and things, because there was a thing like I was always using old home computers to make the music and
yeah.
thing. And then there was a software for the Game Boy or a cartridge called Little Sound DJ,
yeah.
which was really cool, a really cool composition tool.
I think that's what you were using when I met you in New York.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And everyone was using it at some point because it's convenient. You don't have to load it. You don't have to take your disk drive and
right.
your home computer,
yeah,
which is like fragile and big and everything. No, you can just put it in your backpack, your mm-hmm. Game Boy, and make music with it. And at some point, everyone was making music with the Game Boy. And I got a bit bored of that because it all sounded the same in the end.
Okay.
And these old home computers, they're all special with their all own characteristic of sounds. If the whole evening of a party sounds like the same artist, yeah, but it's good. But it, sometimes it's yeah, you want to move further.
I understand.
And I made I think it also like a 2006. I made for this Game Boy cartridge. I made a MIDI interface so you could synchronize it and can control it with your normal
sure.
Gear, with your music instruments. So
a lot of sounds. For those at home who don't know what the MIDI interface entails, musical instrument, digital interface, it lets you use all kinds of sampled instrument sounds or created sounds to make yeah. things sound differently.
It's just like your connection from the controller to the sound generator. That's
there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually what it is, to connect them together, to synchronize them together, that they're all running on the same clock. And so that's what MIDI is used for. And I made this for the Game Boy, and so people could connect it to all their other gear and have everything synchronized. And then it's more than you have the like big synthesizer sounds, and then together with the Game Boy music, for example. And that's what I did back then, also as a hardware project.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, I financed my studies, and that's nice. But I worked already, and before I went 30, I said, like, okay, I do all this electronic stuff, but I don't have the diploma.
Where would you get that?
The grade. I don't have the grade for it. So I stopped my work and went back to study the stuff that I did already.
That's brutal.
I financed it with this Game Boy MIDI interface. I sold it to people.
How old were you then?
Before I went 30. So I worked already 10 years.
That's so cool.
And stopped then to get this, to get the grades. But at some point I stopped with this chip music thing, or at least I stopped making songs myself.
Right.
Say like this. I followed it. I'm still following it a bit. And also my sequence is also a bit like based on this kind of things. But then it's more than this. So it's also like a full grown thing.
Does have the aesthetic of the chip music community.
It does. It does.
For sure.
But I think it's more like combining worlds, because you can hate chip music, but use this as a complete sequencer.
Sure. It's not just for chip music.
It's not for chip music. So yeah. that's the thing. So that's what I also had from the beginning in my mind. I don't want to create a chip music instrument.
Right.
So that's what I didn't want to do. But I wanted to be able to do both parts or all the parts. So
if chip music people want to use it, then that's great.
Oh, and they're using it also.
And they're using it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit like how it went with the chip music scene. I played around, and that's the fun part with this micro music part, and it was growing, and you see like worldwide stuff is going on, and it brought me to the States that I could play there.
Yeah.
I played like a lot of Europe. I played in Russia, and so that's cool stuff you don't do normally.
But even just in town here, like I know you played at what, Rotown or at Worm.
You played Worm
a million times, right? I mean, just having that in your town and going and being able to go and play at the cool place.
Awesome. I'm really, that's
amazing.
It is great.
I mean, it's amazing for me. I think it's cool.
You know, I always liked also the thing around it, because with this kind of stuff, you don't go to the hotel and kill the minibar.
Yeah.
Or something.
You go to the actual bar, have a drink, and go home.
You meet up with the people who are organizing it, who are also into chiptune. I always try to be there for some days.
Yeah.
And then you go around town with them. They show you the nice places, okay. Not the tourist stuff. And you hang around with them. You have breakfast with them and do stuff. And I organize also some stuff at my place when I still lived in Germany in Wuppertal. And then people were coming there and stayed at my place for some days. And we did some things. Like the guy in the jumpsuit.
Yeah, he was the chip music organizer.
And he was coming here as well. And that was like also one of the nice parts. You know, you go around, you have a concert there, and you can be in the town.
It's a cultural exchange. It's nice.
Yeah, exactly. It's like couch surfing. But in a way that you also really have contact with the people. And then exchange also how you do it and how they do it. And
sure.
A lot of non-chiptune talk as well. Yeah. So that's...
I think it's hard to find those communities now. Like, you always read about how all these amazing artists used to drink in the same bar and stuff, or this one was writing letters to that one, and you could go and find the letter collection of this author writing to some other author, these amazingly beautifully written letters, like exchanging ideas. It's nice that still sort of exists.
Yeah, but that was 20 years ago, huh?
Does it still exist, though? I mean, guess, it must, right?
I think it changed changed a bit because around 2000, of course, the internet was there and things were there, but it was also not settled like it is now.
Yeah.
There was not like this thing of YouTube influencers showing you what you have to like or what you should like and do all the work for you. Back then, you have to do the work for yourself. Sure. You ask people, be here, be there, be there. And now it's like an influencer making a whole thing about something and
this
the surrounding
is
it.
This is
of
the
it.
Bible, yeah.
Yeah, that's a bit different thing. Or,
sure.
Or maybe someone writing a blog about it. And that was also before blogs were in. More like, I have a website and I make write something about music. A bit more like this. Can you be, I have also a link page and then I can link you also on a thing. And then you have a lot of links there. That's not there anymore, I think. I think anyway, the internet exists only of two social media sites. And
it is the dominant force.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's also where people spend the most time. And that was different then. And then you were like, going from this website, and then you see on a linked list, and you look on another site. Oh, that's interesting. And they had also a linked list there.
Yeah.
And go to another site again. And that's a bit different. Totally different.
These are actual recommendations from people.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally different than an algorithm that too.
The algorithm isn't always your friend. It does help sometimes when you're shopping for something, but sometimes it's just not great.
It's a problem of our future.
It's going to become sentient and destroy us all. Maybe it already is.
I think it's a problem because it's limiting, I think.
I feel like I discussed this with somebody else on the podcast in academia. Mm-hmm. Everybody is starting to cite the same articles for their papers. So instead of having a wide variety of viewpoints, the viewpoints are getting narrower and narrower because you can just search for them.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
You find them directly. So it must be the definitive source.
Yeah.
And everyone, the definitive source is being basically curated by Google.
Yeah.
Which is problematic. It is problematic.
Yeah, but which is totally different from the early times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or, yeah, I don't know if 2000 wasn't that early anymore, I think.
I'd say internet culture in 2000 was significantly different than it is now.
Yeah.
In 2000, I certainly wouldn't have been searching the internet for instructions on how to do everything.
True, yeah. but you have been... surprised then. I could find, that manual. Oh, how cool is
exactly.
that? I'm looking for this since so long time.
And I do love it. And it's tough. It's tough to, it's tough to break away from it, but there's so many resources. And I even learning software and stuff, I use it all the time.
Yeah.
Shopping, everything. It's a valuable resource, but it is also...
It's time consuming. I try to not... When I'm developing, I turn it off.
That's good.
Just to stay focused on my thing because I know that I would be.
Let me check one thing. I just got to check this.
Yeah, but it stops your flow also.
Yeah, it does. You got to get into the flow. I find that once I'm in the flow, I'm good, but it is easy to distract me. Your education, you said you talked about going back to school later on, but what,
yes.
like, did you learn about programming and stuff?
Before that. Yeah, so I had a bit critical school years. I was like a bit of a problem. I never made my homework. And I was actually elementary school. There was a problem already, never made my homework and things. And then I ended up the high school was like the lower high school.
Okay.
You know, now you know about the problem kids that was always like on a chair,
sure.
like
going howdy, around. Howdy and all that.
And then, and now they can, they can deal with it. And they know if someone is on a spectrum or
sure.
or at least you can you and then you can get also
assistance or
assistant for it
yeah
and things to be able to handle it
sure
and I don't know if I have ADHD
ADHD
yeah uh-huh. a thing but I had problems
sure.
So I made law school. I made 1 year twice because I didn't handle it, and still didn't make my homework, and didn't go to school, and this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but I was able to finish it, the school, and then going for a job.
Yeah,
and there I learned electronics basics,
on the job.
On the job. So in Germany, you learn for a job, and instead of, for example, I stopped school at my 10th year. If you can do three more years, if you're like going to the gymnasium or things,
yeah.
and then you can go to the university.
Yeah.
But I stopped at 10, and then you normally start to learn for a job like car mechanics or something
sure.
like this. And that's what I did. And it was like in electronics. Yeah. And then it was like also in my, I would say in my brain, it makes a bit the click like for.
Sure.
And most probably also because that's what I wanted to do. That's also the thing. I always had trouble with stuff I don't wanted to do. And I was really good in the stuff I wanted to do or I liked.
Were you working on electronics projects all along? Since
No. Yeah, but I did stuff like disassembling the radio and trying to get the police band to listen to the police band and this kind of stuff like hacking these things kind of, but not with the knowledge of doing it. I was trying to program on my computers back then. But I didn't understand the books. The time was not right for me.
No, but also, it's nice to have a project, you know?
Like, yeah.
Like looking at the book and saying, type this, and then like a line will draw or whatever is kind of
exactly.
boring.
Yeah, exactly. But then I could do this already. I did that. I changed basic programs and tried to hack in there, hack there. But like all this logic, mathematics and this kind of stuff, I just didn't get it at this point when I started, but maybe I was 10 or something and I just couldn't read the book. It was too, you know, maybe I had the wrong book and was already expecting like a higher knowledge of stuff or something.
Of course.
And I learned then programming with this when learning the job. Mm-hmm. So it's like 4 days work, 1 day school or 2 days school. So it was like a combination of things. And then I could do stuff and could do a bit of programming. And I liked it. So I learned myself more and more of it.
Sure.
I'm always like a do-it-yourself guy, learning by doing.
Yeah.
And now it's like if I don't know anything, then I teach myself how to do it, reading the sources or getting there and try to understand it. And that's something I missed before, but that's something I can do very good now because it's interesting and that's the motivation to be able to get there.
Yeah, well, that's like if you have a project in mind, then it makes it easier. I was looking up to refresh my mind about your stuff. I found a video online of you in some kind of a basement or something, and Thomas K was recording you working on this vocoder project, is like an old guitar pedal or something that you that you had attached a MIDI interface to. And anyway, it was kind of hilarious because Thomas has been on the podcast as
well.
And so you hear him in his Thomas voice, I am Thomas K, calm and rational. And you're saying, and you've got this microphone.
Yeah, exactly. But this kind of projects I did all the time. And with this, you learn also stuff yourself about things or, oh, how can I do it? And then I'm able to learn myself this stuff. And that's, yeah. And then that was my school. So not good at first, but then in secondary the second try was like because I did what I wanted to do and stuff. And that was like sleeping and getting the grades. And that was with when I was working. And then when I was before 30, I thought like, I need the grades for it. I need a diploma. I need my... Because Elsa would have worked always with low wages, but doing the work for the high wages.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's what I did already. But that's also typical German. You need this paper to show, and then you get a good job, and then you get a good work.
Right.
And then you get paid for it. And
only with the paper, not with the experience.
It's different in the Netherlands, I have to say.
Is it?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Because no one is interested in the papers here.
For programming, maybe.
But for programming, probably also for other stuff.
Yeah.
It's more like, okay, you say you can do it, or you learned it and you can do it, and then you are there, you show it, and then it's fine.
Okay. It sounds to me that your whole trajectory is based on your interests, and I think that that's super cool. It's inspiring to me. I mean, I'm not sure how I would apply it to myself. I don't have the same sort of thing. I just think it's super cool. It's not something that would ever occur to me to give up my income to build a musical instrument, and it's working out, and I think that's great.
It's in a way crazy for me, especially because I never was someone of risk.
Yeah.
So we didn't have a lot of money with my parents. So it was like, and I was had always the idea, oh, I don't want to have this later.
Yes.
And so I always worked and always or never took any risks. And this is like the biggest risk you can take when you already have the family and stuff, you know, like, but I tried it. It's okay. But
it keeps the bills paid.
It keeps the bills paid.
Keeps you occupied.
It keeps me occupied, and that I have to go on with this. It's not like that I can change the job. Oh, I don't like this company anymore. I change the job or something. So
yeah, the boss is a jerk.
Yeah, that's tell me every day, like on the mirror, like oh,
stupid.
Okay, you have to go to work.
I think we're done. Do you have something that you'd like to share?
Can I do some great? No.
Yes.
No, I think it's fine. Yeah.
Okay. So. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Yeah.
That was Thomas. If it wasn't clear, I'm very impressed. Not only with Thomas's skills, but also that he has the guts to drop reliable paid employment for something as challenging as building synthesizers and sequencers. In this case, I think the key to making small-scale hardware production work is intimacy. The market is niche, and he doesn't ignore his customers. He keeps open lines of communication with his market, and he listens and gives them what they need. Seems obvious, but it's not always easy or even possible to do that. If you want to let me know what you need, I keep an open line of communication. Send me an email or something. mail@feelfreetodeviate.com. But no promises. You can find Thomas's company and NerdSec at the XOR Electronics website. That's XOR-electronics.com. He's also on social media. On Instagram, he's XOR Electronics. On Facebook, he's XOR Electronics. He also has a NerdSec Facebook page, and that's NERDSEQ, as in sequencer. For the old school blippity chip music flavor, check out www.firestarter-music.de. Of course, you can also check out Feel Free to Deviate all over the freaking internet. I'm on Instagram and Facebook at Feel Free to Deviate. Feel free to like, comment on, and share the stuff there. Also go to feelfreetodeviate.com if you like visiting websites. If you'd like to send me a message, you can send smoke signals if you're careful. But if you're more practical, send an email to mail@feelfreetodeviate.com. Check the show notes for the actual links that I just mentioned. Oh, and speaking of links, special thanks to Ed from boomkaas.com, that's boomkaas.com, for his masterful audio editing and post-production. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me, Thomas. I really appreciate it. And thank you, dear audience, for listening to us talk. I sincerely hope that you're getting something out of all this. Next up is Gretchen Licata. The name may sound familiar because I talked to her man, Ben, a few episodes ago. Gretchen is the facilities director of the Pioneer Valley School District in Western Massachusetts. You can hear all about that in 2 weeks. Thanks again for listening. You're a peach. Bye.